You definitely don't want to see that, especially on day one of OTAs. But like I said, we have to continue to get better, continue to improve. You know, one man down, somebody has to step up and answer the bell.
That was the immediate aftermath of yesterday's surprising and, for the Cowboys, devastating news that Sean Lee has a knee injury. By all accounts and appearances, it's a torn ACL that will knock him out for the balance of the 2014 football season. Anytime a guy tears an ACL in the offseason, though, I think back to Rod Woodson, 1995, week one, tore an ACL against the Detroit Lions, came back and played in Super Bowl 30 against the Dallas Cowboys. Now, the Cowboys would have to be willing to carry Sean Lee on the roster, the active roster, for the entire season. I guess they could carry him and then put him on injured reserve with the designation of return, and then he'd be back. But at some point, they're going to have to put him on the roster. They're going to have to swing this. They're going to have to work this out if they think he could play at some point. Actually, that IR with designation of return gives them a little flexibility if they think there's any chance he'd be ready to go. Of course, January football may be out of the question for the Dallas Cowboys, with or without Sean Lee. And that's one of the things that surprised me about this the most. Yes, it's a devastating injury for the player, for the team, especially the player who has had a history of injuries over the years that have affected his ability to really get the most out of his abilities. Look at this laundry list. Not quite Gronk-like, not Cavity Sam from a surgery standpoint, but still bad for the player, bad for the team, but not really devastating for the team because the defense was bad anyway. I mean, this isn't like the 1985 Bears losing Mike Singletary. Of course, if they had, they'd still have many other potent parts. The Cowboys have one really, really good defensive player left. It's Sean Lee. Is he going to make up for the fact that the other 10 guys are meh? I don't know that it really matters for the Cowboys. It's the team's going to have to win with offense, and that's the real impact of yesterday's injury. The only way this team is going to have any success in 2014 is with a high-powered offense. That's even more pressure on Tony Romo to recover from that second back surgery in 2 years. So Dallas Cowboys get their hopes derailed, at least for now. We'll see how it all plays out. Everybody's still 0-0. A lot can happen, but there aren't many options out there for the Cowboys. Not many middle linebackers just sitting around. Maybe they can lure London Fletcher out of retirement after all those years he spent in Washington. Brian Urlacher is a guy I thought they should have been interested in a year ago. Maybe they'd, I doubt that Brian Urlacher is going to come back and play, but those are the options that the Cowboys have to at least consider because there aren't many good choices out there. And the one point that the Lee injury reiterates, and we know this is going to happen every year, there will be injuries. We just don't know who and when and how long, but those injuries disrupt any preconceived notions we try to develop about the coming football season. That's why it's ridiculous, it's preposterous to try to predict who's going to be in the Super Bowl at this point, who's going to make it to the playoffs at this point. When the schedule came out last month, people actually picking the winners of games to be played in December. That was even before the draft. I mean, it's just a ludicrous exercise. It's a waste of time. The Sean Lee injury proves what a waste of time it really is, because who knows who else on the Cowboys, on any other team, will tear an ACL between now and week one of the regular season, or ultimately the first weekend in February. The Jaguars would like to play some games in February or January. It's been a long time since they've been to the postseason, but they're trying to turn things around. And look, I'm skeptical of any team that takes a quarterback in the first round and acts like that quarterback's going to sit on the bench. Because, first of all, you don't take a quarterback in round one unless you're ready to play him. And second of all, if you're going to make him a backup, that means he's going to be behind the number two offensive line. That means this prized asset is going to be put at even greater risk in the preseason, whether that's the Jaguars and Bortles, the Vikings and Teddy Bridgewater, or the Browns and Johnny Manziel. But I think we're starting to see the process. And I think the mindset is you drop the guy down on the depth chart, and then there's nowhere to go but up, and then you start building him up, and you start giving him confidence, and you hope that confidence that he develops, maybe artificially within the confines of his football organization, will translate to confidence when he's thrust into action as of week one. And just like with Ryan Tannehill and the Dolphins 2 years ago, when he was number three in training camp, I knew he was going to be the starter week one. Now, I don't feel quite as strongly about Bortles, Manziel, and Bridgewater this year because there's three teams that are playing this game, but I still believe. In light of the comments that came yesterday from offensive coordinator Jed Fish praising Blake Bortles, work ethic, committed to working hard and doing things right. His study habits have been excellent. His questions have been excellent. Eventually, that's going to be his performance on the field has been excellent. Everything is excellent. Of course, it's excellent because we use the third overall pick on the guy. If he's not good enough to beat out Chad Henne, why in the hell do we use the third overall pick on Blake Bortles? It's that simple. Sometimes it really is that simple, which I'm grateful for because it's easier for my limited brain to process and comprehend. You don't make Bortles the third overall pick if you're going to put him on the bench. But you do make him the backup, at least for now, so he earns his stripes. So there's no perception anything's been given to him. So he has an opportunity to go out there and show that he can overcome adversity. Because guess what? When it's time to play games, you're going to have to overcome adversity. And we've seen great quarterbacks like Vince Young who weren't able to overcome adversity. What happens? A career falls apart. So teach the guy early how to deal with adversity, even if it's in kind of a laboratory setting. And then you work him along, you groom him, you nurture him, you protect him by only letting him play behind the starting offensive line in preseason. And then he's ready to go week one. I'm starting to think Blake Bortles the most likely of the three rookies to start week one, although I still think the other two probably will as well. The only one that I'm still a little sketchy about is Teddy Bridgewater in Minnesota because I'm still not sure whether or not they want to kind of put him on scholarship for a year, especially since they're playing outdoors in Minnesota. The Texans sometimes play outdoors, sometimes play indoors. They've got that roof. That's the best segue I could come up with. Sorry. But speaking of quarterbacks, that would have been a better segue. In Houston, supposedly the competition there is wide open, and the candidates are not great. You've got Ryan Fitzpatrick, who, and look, I know Ryan Fitzpatrick, a fan of PFT. At one point he learned he was traded by the Bengals in a PFT post. He's been on the program. He had a big contract from the Bills. He washed out. But the Titans could have kept Ryan Fitzpatrick on the roster for $3.25 million this year at a time when nobody knows if Jake Locker is going to be healthy. What did they do? They cut Fitzpatrick, and they went with Charlie Whitehurst. I almost said Billy White Wolf. That would have been a very old and dated pro wrestling reference. Chief J. Strongbow and Billy White Wolf, circa 1975 or thereabouts. But Charlie Whitehurst was the preference in Tennessee over Ryan Fitzpatrick. So now it's Fitzpatrick, it's Tom Savage, who fell to what, round four? And it's Case Keenum, he's still floating around. Where's T.J. Yates? Is he still in the building? Who's going to be the quarterback of this team? And, you know, there's a sense out there that, oh, the Texans just had a one-year aberration and they'll get everything back together. Not if their quarterback is even worse than Matt Schaub. And that's saying a lot, or as the case may be, not very much. Atlanta, aberration. Houston, maybe the start of a trend. Houston maybe should have drafted a quarterback a little earlier than round four, and Houston may want to be thinking about other options that may come available as training camp unfolds, as the offseason continues. Who knows? Maybe some guy will get cut. Maybe something will happen. Maybe somebody will be available via trade. But I just can't see the Houston Texans feeling all that great about their current quarterback position. Maybe the Patriots will trade Tom Brady to Houston and give the job to Jimmy Garoppolo. I'd like to say crazier things have happened, but I really think that would be crazier than anything that has happened in recent years or ever in the NFL. Speaking of crazy things happening in the NFL, what better team to focus on today than the Miami Dolphins? Armando Salguero of the Miami Herald will be joining us. Things have settled down for the Dolphins, which means they've gotten kind of boring. So we're going to try to spice things up a little bit. Is there some controversy that we can maybe prod and poke and get into with Armando? We'll find out coming up, and then we'll find out if you can poke and prod me with any questions that maybe I can't answer. But even if you stump me, I'll just talk until you forget what you asked. That's the secret to this business. If you're asked a question you don't know the answer to, just answer a different question. And then by the time you're done, hopefully the person who asked you the question will forget the question that they asked now. I forget what we're doing next. Armando Salguero, Miami Herald. We'll do that after the break. Stick around. This is PFT Live.
I would describe it as the Miami Dolphins' offense, first and foremost. It's not one individual. We want to see an offense that plays fast with tempo. We want to see an offense that does a great job taking care of the football. And we want to see an offense that's explosive. So those are really the parameters. That hasn't changed.
That's Dolphins coach Joe Philbin reacting to some discussion, especially in light of the hiring of Bill Lazor to be the offensive coordinator, that the Dolphins' offense will be more like the Eagles' offense. And really, some would say if it's anything other than similar to the Dolphins' offense, maybe it'll be a successful offense. Joining us now to help us understand what's happening on both sides of the ball and otherwise with the Miami Dolphins, our good friend Armando Salguero of the Miami Herald. And let's start with that. Do you really think this team is going to try to mimic Chip Kelly? Has he had that much of an impact in only 1 year of lifetime NFL experience?
Well, I think that he has had impact on Bill Lazor, who's the new offensive coordinator for the Dolphins, who worked last year for Chip Kelly. But it's not going to be the Chip Kelly offense. Bill Lazor has worked for a lot of people around the NFL and has picked and choose from, you know, the different kind of places he's been. One thing I think that you're going to see overall from the Dolphins offense, it's going to be Air Coryell inspired. There's going to be a lot of timing passes to wide receivers. There's going to be a lot of deep throws first and then come back down the field. They're going to do a lot of inside running. The Dolphins will actually motion their wide receivers this year, something that Dolphin fans pulled their hair out last year because Mike Sherman, the former offensive coordinator, decided that wasn't really a way to get somebody open. You didn't really need to do that. You lined up the wide receivers in the same spot practically every single play, and obviously that didn't work.
And what do we expect the impact of this new approach to be on the receivers, specifically the receiver in whom they made a major financial commitment last year, who didn't seem to be happy at times, if not all the time, with his role, Mike Wallace?
I think it'll be a good thing for Mike Wallace. It can't be any worse, really, than last year. Last year, Mike Wallace was frustrated. He didn't think he had a good season, and he didn't necessarily blame himself for that. Dolphin fans, meanwhile, were seeing a lot of Mike Wallace losing 50-50 balls in the air because, let's face it, his ball skills are not that good. But Mike Wallace was thinking more along the lines of, hey, you know what? I was open behind the secondary at least a dozen times last year, and the ball would invariably either get overthrown or underthrown, but never thrown on, you know, on pace, never thrown in stride. And that's 12 touchdowns that you're talking about right there. That would have helped the Dolphins be something better than 26th in the NFL in points scored.
If they could go back to March of 2013, would they sign Mike Wallace again or move on to someone else?
I don't think they would have signed Mike Wallace again, especially not to that contract. You know, there was talk that the Minnesota Vikings came in late during that process and actually offered Mike Wallace more money. Mike Wallace came to the Dolphins because the Dolphins' quarterback situation was better, and he liked the idea of living closer to home. But if you gave both entities a chance to redo that very same contract, I don't think either one of them would do it.
What is the quarterback situation in Miami? Year three for Ryan Tannehill. What do we expect by way of performance?
He's got to improve. He's got to continue to improve. The ironic thing is he has done that, but now he's got to do it under a different offense. Ryan Tannehill, for the last 3 years, for the last 52 games that he has started at quarterback both in Miami and at Texas A&M, was under the Mike Sherman offense. And so he knew everything backwards and forwards. As a matter of fact, when he was a rookie, he was teaching veterans on the field what the offense was about. That's not the case anymore. This offense is new to him as well as everybody else. And, in fact, there are some players on the team who have been in a Coryell type of offense before. Cam Cameron ran it at LSU, and Jarvis Landry, a rookie wide receiver, is pretty much up to date and up to speed with what Bill Lazor wants to do a little bit. So Ryan Tannehill, the onus is on him to get better even as he's learning new tricks, new things, and being asked to do more from Bill Lazor. And I think that's very important because I think there was a comfort level between Mike Sherman and Ryan Tannehill, where Ryan Tannehill wasn't necessarily pushed all the time. He's not being pushed by anyone on the roster. I think Ryan Tannehill will benefit by being pushed from someone in the coaching staff.
Which statement is more accurate, that the offense is being adapted to Ryan Tannehill or that Ryan Tannehill is being adapted to the offense?
The latter. I think that it's Bill Lazor's offense. He believes that the players are in on the roster that will fit the offense. Obviously, they're going to be a zone-blocking offensive line. Ryan Tannehill is the perfect quarterback for that kind of offense, really, because he has really a great arm. Velocity, he gets it out fairly quickly when he's made the decision. It's the deep ball accuracy that continues to bedevil him, and in this offense, more often than not, it's about timing. So it's not about getting the ball to a receiver. It's about getting the ball to a place and relying on the receiver to be there. Maybe that'll be best for him.
One of the great lessons I learned personally from the series Breaking Bad is the danger of making half measures in lieu of full measures. And when you talk about former offensive coordinator Mike Sherman, feels like that was a half measure, that he was a scapegoat, that the Dolphins should have gone the rest of the way and just hired a new coaching staff. Your thoughts?
Well, owner Stephen Ross has gone the half measure route for years now. You'll remember that when he took over, he has told me that he would have liked to put in his own people, but that Bill Parcells at the time was an untouchable because of the fact that Parcells had just taken a 1-15 team and taken them to the playoffs at 11-5 as the general manager, remade the roster. So in 2009, when Ross took over, it was like, you can't mess with this. Well, eventually he decided that he didn't like the head coach, Tony Sperano, very much, but really liked Jeff Ireland, the general manager, a lot. So when times dictated a change, he changed the head coach and not the general manager. Well, last year he decided that Jeff Ireland was no longer one of his favorites, but he really liked Joe Philbin. So he kept the coach and changed the general manager. And every time you hire, a brain trust and you're hiring, but also dictating that they must accept the head coach if you're hiring the general manager, or the general manager, if you're hiring a head coach, you're going to automatically lose a pool of candidates that are good enough to say, no, I want to run it my way. I want my people from top to bottom. And if you don't do it that way, I'll wait for the next opportunity. Typically, the people that come in being forced or having either a GM or a head coach heaved upon them are not as complete a candidate, not as accomplished a candidate.
Why is it then that these titans of industry like Stephen Ross, Jimmy Haslam, others who have earned millions if not billions in other lines of work can't realize that you don't treat a football organization the same way that you would treat any other business, that it is so much more important in a football operation for everyone to be on the same page, to engage not in half measures 1 year at a time, but just rip the Band-Aid off and start over again? Will Stephen Ross ever figure that out?
I think the next time around, he'll probably figure that out. Why he hasn't figured it out yet, I don't know. I would say this. Yeah, those people are titans of industry, but there are no, classes in college or university-level classes for ownership of NFL teams. These guys generally make a lot of mistakes when they're new to the game. The hope is that they learn quickly and they move on from those mistakes to the point where they can erase them. Some folks move a little faster than others. And right now, I think that Steve Ross didn't really learn from his first half measure, as you were talking about, and is into his second half measure. We'll see if this one works.
Well, from half measures from one of my favorite shows, Breaking Bad, to another one of my favorite shows, Seinfeld, what's the deal with Mike Pouncey? What's his deal? What's his problem? What's his issue? And why do the Dolphins seem to be coddling him?
Well, I think the issue with Mike Pouncey is he's his own guy, and he doesn't have a filter, and he's a little bit tone deaf. I remember last year having a conversation with Mike Pouncey that was very uncomfortable at the point where he was asking me, well, don't you think that the entire harassment scandal, so-called Bullygate, was just a media fabrication? And I said, no. Do you? And he said, yes. It's just you guys that did all this. And I'm thinking, really? I said to him, so us guys, meaning the media, you know, were the ones that sent the text messages? Us guys, meaning the media, were the ones that suspended your friend and a teammate, Richie Incognito? This is us guys, meaning the media, or the ones that compel Jonathan Martin to flee the team? At that point, he kind of turned away from me, and you know, it wasn't comfortable. Let's put it that way. But it showed me how he doesn't really get the seriousness of what was going on. He doesn't really understand why it was a big deal. And I don't think he still does. I don't think, you know, to him, yesterday, as he talked about, I have no regrets about anything that happened last year. Well, that's fine if you feel that way, Mike, but don't say that, you know, because you're going to get ripped on mercilessly for that. Just either give it a no comment or whatever, but that you really think that leads people to wonder and worry whether you're going to, you know, be part of the next scandal that hits the, you know, the NFL because you didn't learn from the last one.
And meanwhile, he expects a new contract. He's eligible for that second deal. He's got 3 years in under his rookie contract. Is he tone deaf and unfiltered when it comes to whether or not he truly believes the Dolphins will reward him, notwithstanding all these other issues?
Well, he has every right to believe that they will reward him with a new contract for the reasons that follow. Number one reason is he's a really good player. And that's a really big deal to the Miami Dolphins because they need as many good players as they can have. They have decided, obviously, in the way that they treat Mike Pouncey, that being a good player and being, you know, borderline, I mean, the guy is borderline elite at his position. If you're that, we'll look the other way in certain instances over certain things, and we plan to keep you. Moreover, you know, when the Dolphins signed Brandon Albert as a free, you know, their signature free agent acquisition, they brought in Ryan Tannehill and another player to come and dine with Joe Philbin and Albert and Dennis Hickey, the general manager. You know who that other player was, signifying his leadership and his status on the team? Mike Pouncey. Now, that's the Dolphins that decided that. That's management that decided he had that he was on that pedestal. So I would say to you that, you know, they've made their bed with Mike Pouncey. They're sticking with Mike Pouncey, and primarily it's because he's a good player.
Now, you've got other holes on that offensive line, given the absence of Jonathan Martin and Richie Incognito. They drafted Juwan James. That was something that you had pegged in advance of the selection process. And also Billy Turner, you had a recent item about Billy Turner and his background and the irony that he was a bullying victim, albeit from his older brother. What do we expect from those two rookies? Will either or both be in the starting lineup?
Yeah, well, Juwan James, yesterday at the first OTA of the offseason, he was the starting right tackle. And if he's not that on opening day, something went horribly, horribly wrong for the Miami Dolphins. He has to be their starter. He has to be proficient and efficient at his job because, frankly, the Dolphins, you know, while they have good backup players at that spot, they don't have a good starter candidate for that spot. So Juwan James, the pressure is on to be and come as build. At the guard position, Billy Turner, you know, he's fighting with, you know, he's a later round pick. He's a third round pick. If he doesn't start right away, people will understand. He's getting some repetitions with the first team, but he's also getting repetitions with players that are more experienced than him. The fact that he comes from FCS school, North Dakota State, probably means he's got a little bit more catching up to do than most rookies. I think he's going to do that. Interestingly, I think that Billy Turner has a higher ceiling than Juwan James. Billy Turner is raw right now, but his abilities suggest that he can be something special down the road. Juwan James is more NFL ready right now, but, you know, he's going to be okay. He's going to be good. I don't know if he's going to be great.
By all appearances, Deion Jordan, the third overall pick in last year's draft, was not NFL ready as a rookie. I noticed that there's been some raving about how he seems to be larger. Will his performance be improved, in your estimation, this year?
Well, that depends on whether he gets a chance to perform. The fact of the matter is the Dolphins last year moved up in the draft to number 3 overall from number 12 to get Deion and then didn't play him all that much. And it was interesting because as he got better, he played less late in the season than he did earlier in the season. It was baffling, and I understand the Dolphins have two pretty decent, well, one very outstanding defensive end in Cam Wake, and then a decent player in Olivier Vernon. But this guy is your number 3 overall pick. You got to figure out a way to get him in the lineup. You got to figure out a way to get him in on third downs because he makes stuff happen typically. The Dolphins never figured that out. He believes that he's going to be better this year based on the fact that he finally had an off-season program to get bigger, to get better. The shoulder surgery that limited him in training camp last year is a distant memory. So things are looking up for him. But the thing that kind of worries me about his situation is Olivier Vernon and Cam Wake haven't gone anywhere. And the defensive coordinator, Kevin Coyle, is the same. And so those things, those variables not changing, how is it that Deion Jordan all of a sudden is going to get more playing time? That's problematic for the Dolphins to figure out.
Well, and as you explain that, I assume or at least hope there are some Seahawks fans out there paying attention to this saying, why not just use everybody repeatedly in a rotation that keeps everyone fresh, keeps everyone healthy, and keeps quarterbacks running for their lives? Why don't they just use a rotation and put him on the field more and give Wake and Jordan an opportunity to get a breather and to keep themselves fresh during a game and healthier over the course of a season?
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's my fault for not mentioning Derek Shelby is another defensive end that also got more snaps last year than Deion Jordan. So somewhere along the line, someone is going to have to lose snaps so that Deion Jordan can gain snaps. At the same time, you talk to the coaching staff, as I have, and they're putting it on Deion Jordan. It's up to Deion Jordan to make us put him in the game. When he gets his opportunities, he's got to be big. He's got to make plays. Otherwise, we'll just stay the way we're going because we like the players that we're playing. He has to force the issue. In that regard, it's in his hands.
Last topic for you, and we talked earlier about the development of Ryan Tannehill. Earlier in the program, I addressed my own belief that this idea that Blake Bortles in Jacksonville, Teddy Bridgewater in Minnesota, Johnny Manziel in Cleveland, they've been intentionally parked at a lower rung on the depth chart in the hopes that they'll go nowhere but up. Ryan Tannehill at one point was number 3 as a rookie. I never bought it. I never believed it. When you reflect on the Dolphins' experience 2 years ago and you look at what's happening with these other teams, do you have a sense that this is just all part of a ruse, all part of a rigged competition, or do you see differences in what's happening now and what happened with the Dolphins?
Well, with the Dolphins, it was always a fait accompli. You know, there was no way that the 2012 season was going to play out without Ryan Tannehill factoring in somehow. That it played out faster than what the team maybe had planned? Yeah, I'll give you that, because obviously David Garrard had an injury and he couldn't play. And then Matt Moore completed 39% of his passes in the preseason. And Ryan Tannehill had completed 57% of his passes in the preseason. And anyone with eyes said, which one of those two is better? Let's go with the 57% and fewer interceptions. That was one of those things that played out in the preseason where it was almost forced upon the Dolphins to play Ryan Tannehill early. But the plan, you know, was it he's always going to be the starter? Well, no, but he's going to be the starter pretty soon, and it was just a little bit sooner than they expected.
Well, we're done a little bit later than I expected, but it's great stuff. As always, appreciate you giving us some time. We will be bothering you again soon. And thanks as always, and have a great day.
All right, Mike. Take care now.
All right, there he is, our good friend Armando Salguero of the Miami Herald, all things Dolphins. We could have kept going and going and going. He had some great stuff there, great perspective on a team that has gotten a little boring in recent weeks and months, and most Dolphins fans are probably happy about that. Most PFT Planet fans, or would it be Planeteers? I don't know. We don't need a goofy name like that. Either way, it's now time to pick up your cell phone device and dial 888-237-5269. I always say cell phone, but I guess there are still landlines, and maybe somewhere there are rotary dial phones. Either way, 888-237-5269 is the number. We'll be back. We got some Twitter questions. Hopefully we'll have some phone calls. One way to find out is to stay with us. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. It is PFT Planet time here, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages. Time to answer your questions via Twitter, phone, or telepathy, if any of you have mastered that. First one from Chris Poor SID, who has mastered the Twitter. Would like for you to expand on physicality of OTAs. Will the union get involved regarding Sean Lee? You know what? This is a tricky situation for the NFLPA. On one hand, there are rights that the players have obtained via the 2011 collective bargaining agreement. Frankly, those rights were in there previously, to avoid any and all live contact, no bump and run drills between defensive backs and receivers, no one-on-one drills between offensive linemen and defensive linemen, no live contact at the offseason workouts. You've got guys in helmets with no pads. I've been hearing for years complaints about how this works, because what happens is they are going live. It is football. They're playing football. And when guys have helmets on and not pads, those helmets bang into shoulders and bang guys up and nick guys up. But guys are out there realizing that this is their opportunity to get the coach's attention, whether it's to make the team, whether it's to stay on the team, whether it's to climb the depth chart, whether it's to keep the spot that the player's already earned on the depth chart. Testosterone takes over, whether it's natural or artificially enhanced. The coaching staff isn't about to tell guys to not go out and play hard. And the next thing you know, you have injuries, you have accounts from guys like the Chiefs' sixth-round draft pick, Zach Fulton. We mentioned him at PFT earlier this week because he came out and said, hey, these minicamps are even more physical than people think. Well, they're not supposed to be physical at all. So the NFLPA has to decide, how much of a stickler do you really want to be, when the reality is guys need to get ready for the season and teams need to be able to figure out who the best players are. Haven't heard anything yet from the NFLPA about contact. Don't know whether we will, but I've asked to see what their position is, and I think their position is try to find a way to strike this balance that helps the teams, because if you help the teams, you help the players. I'm going to help myself to the phone line right now. John in Wisconsin, you're on PFT Live.
Hey, fellas. What's up? Hey, I had a question for you regarding Vikings quarterback Teddy Bridgewater. One, do you think he'll be the week one starter? And two, how much of an impact can he have in Minnesota year one?
I think, and thank you for the call, I think it's going to be a lot for Teddy Bridgewater to have an instant impact. Now, Norv Turner, kind of an underrated quarterback guru. We talk about Jim Harbaugh and Andy Reid. Norv Turner doesn't get a lot of mention there, but look at Cleveland last year. Look at the numbers Josh Gordon was able to rack up at receiver with Brandon Whedon and Jason Campbell and Brian Hoyer and whoever else ended up taking snaps. So maybe Norv Turner has an underrated Midas touch that we haven't really focused on before. He was the guy who developed Troy Aikman. He did work wonders initially with Alex Smith before leaving to become the Chargers head coach. So I just don't know what we should expect. I think the expectations for the Vikings should be low this year, and maybe they'll exceed them, just like 2 years ago when the expectations were low and they exceeded them all the way to a playoff berth. Back to the Twitter queue, Twitter stack, Twitter bag, Twitter whatever, at Butch Alsander. Do you think Jadeveon Clowney will become another J.J. Watt? Mario Williams was elite but did not dominate like Watt. Not many defensive players in the NFL have dominated like Watt in recent years. Watt's only entering year four. Can he continue what we have seen from him? Some thought that guys like Khalil Mack would have been actually a better fit for the Texans' defense than Clowney. The challenge will be to adapt the defense to Clowney, not adapt Clowney to the defense. But when you have multiple guys that will presumably command double teams, you know what that helps? That helps everybody else on that defensive line who is not going to be getting the extra attention. But I think Clowney can be very good. He can be a freakish talent. He has to want it. And what better guy to be in position to mentor him than J.J. Watt, who has really set the standard in just a couple of NFL seasons after becoming the 11th overall pick back in 2011. Speaking of the Texans, we go to Houston. Joe, you're on the phone. You're up. This is PFT Live. Welcome aboard.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good, buddy.
Yes, Mike. Good. My question is, who do you think the starting quarterback for the Texans will be? During OTAs yesterday, Bill O'Brien said it's pretty wide open at this point.
I'm still not ruling out the possibility that they'll trade for Tom Brady. And again, I'm just joking about that. But when you consider that they waited until round four to draft a quarterback, because as the draft unfolded, people were thinking, hey, you know what? Maybe there's a chance they'll trade for Ryan Mallett. But Savage ended up being the guy. The veterans are Fitzpatrick, Keenum, and Yates. Fitzpatrick probably has the edge because he's the free agent who was signed. Could Savage come in and take over? I mean, this wouldn't be as shocking as Russell Wilson taking over in Seattle 2 years ago when you consider that $10 million guaranteed was paid to Matt Flynn in free agency. Fitzpatrick didn't get nearly that much. So it wouldn't be a major upset if Savage comes in and takes over. But he'll have to come in and truly take over. That's what Russell Wilson did. People say, oh, Pete Carroll did a gutsy thing by making Russell Wilson the starting quarterback. No, Pete Carroll did what he had to do to avoid a mutiny because everybody on that team knew that Russell Wilson was the best quarterback. And if Carroll hadn't gone with Russell Wilson, Carroll would have had a major problem. Tom Savage has the opportunity to put Bill O'Brien in that same position where even if he'd like to go with a veteran player, that Tom Savage can come in and make it clear to everyone that he's the best option. Our best option now is to go back to the phone lines. Grant in Tampa, you're on PFT Live.
Hey, just calling in to talk about what happened yesterday in Valley Ranch. Back when the draft was happening, you know, the Cowboys draft room had a big discussion about whether or not to draft Manziel. And my question is, what do you think, if any, the backlash will be from Jerry to the rest of the people in that draft room now that the guy that they chose instead of Manziel has injured arguably their defense because of the absence of DeMarcus Ware? Sean Lee was pretty much the best player they had on defense, and now their defense is just atrocious.
And it's a great point, and a lot of people thought of that yesterday when the reports emerged that it was Zach Martin who rolled up on Sean Lee. Now, some think that it looks like Lee's knee buckled before there was contact, but you know, it's a very simple exercise to say, well, if they had just drafted Johnny Manziel, this wouldn't have happened. But I don't think Jerry Jones is going to think that way. Look, it's happened. Injuries are going to happen. Regardless of how they happen, where they happen, when they happen, we know they will happen, and you have to be prepared, and you have to move forward. Johnny Manziel wasn't going to help that defense be any better this year. Zach Martin's not going to help the defense be any better this year. Without Sean Lee, they've got to come up with a plan B. The good news is, it's not like the defense was that great. Now, I know they were relying upon Sean Lee to at least make them somewhat competitive, but if this team wins, it was always going to be with its offense, not its defense, and now it's going to rely even more on its offense. Back to the phone lines. Nick in Kansas City, you're on PFT Live.
Hey, Mike, big fan. Just calling to see if you think the Chiefs are serious about keeping Alex Smith or if it's just coach speak PR, you know, if they're blowing smoke. Also, real quick, if you could tell Ross Tucker to take it easy on Eric Fisher today on the show, I'd really appreciate it.
I will tell him. Thank you. Yes, Ross Tucker is not a member or the president of the Eric Fisher fan club. Fisher still struggling at times, but he's learning the ropes. He was the first overall pick in 2013. Ross has been critical of him on multiple occasions. The Chiefs have been saying that they expect to get Alex Smith's contract done. Alex Smith's camp is putting out the idea that there are no talks, there are no meaningful talks, and the challenge is putting the right value on Alex Smith. Now, the Chiefs were willing to give up what ultimately became two second-round picks to get Alex Smith in lieu of using that number one overall pick last year on a quarterback, in large part because there were no quarterbacks that merited that number one overall pick. But they liked Alex Smith. He performed extremely well last year. The question is, what is he worth? He just turned 30 on May the 8th, so he's got a lot of football left in him. I think the Chiefs are in position where you look at it and say, what's the rush? We got him under contract for another year. Why hurry? Why not wait and see what we like or don't like about Aaron Murray? Maybe we just go with Aaron Murray next year. Maybe he gets Kaepernicked again and Alex Smith gets shipped out of Kansas City or he ends up having to sign somewhere else as a free agent. I argued last night that the Falcons were premature in their decision to give Matt Ryan a huge contract. If Alex Smith wants really big money, same mindset applies to Colin Kaepernick. If Kaepernick wants $20 million, and we've yet to hear what Smith really wants, but let's look at Kaepernick. If he wants $20 million a year, make him earn it. And Kaepernick's got far less experience than Smith, but Smith has, relatively speaking, equal success or even less success than Kaepernick despite his years in the league. I want Smith to prove it. And if he proves it, then I'll pay him what he wants. I'm probably not going to have to pay him a whole lot more. And if he wins the Super Bowl and I got to give him a Joe Flacco contract, well, you know what? If I've got that Super Bowl under my arm, I'll gladly give the guy $20 million a year. But make him earn it. Why pay the money prematurely and risk a slide? And if Aaron Murray ends up developing and he's healthy, he had no limitations in minicamp, maybe he's your guy come 2015. Another Twitter question. At DKLish, or some combination thereof. What do the New York Giants need in order to make it to the playoffs this season? Better players. better players, better coaching, better moves. Other than that, everything's fine. We talked about the Giants last night on Pro Football Talk on NBCSN, and the pass rush is a shell of what it used to be. And I know it wasn't necessarily the pass rush that got the Giants to the playoffs those years. It was a combination of factors. But that pass rush really helped deliver Super Bowl titles in 2007, early 2008, and 2011, early 2012, the last two times they won the Super Bowl. They used that 12th overall pick, not on Aaron Donald, who really could have come in and provided a disrupting force in the interior defensive line. They went with Odell Beckham Jr. to replace Akeem Nicks, which wasn't really a vote of confidence for Reuben Randall, who apparently was doing well at receiver. So the pass rush needs to improve. Who's the tight end? We were talking about that last night, both during the show and on break. Who's the tight end in New York? And maybe they would have pounced on Eric Ebron if he was available at number 12, but he wasn't. The Lions took him. And no tight end of note. Pass rush has disintegrated. Eli Manning may be jeopardizing whatever Hall of Fame credentials he had from those two Super Bowl wins. Other than that, everything's great for the New York Giants. So yeah, I think it's going to take a lot. The good news is they're in the NFC East, although it seems like the Eagles are pulling away from the rest. We're going to pull away from today's edition of PFT Live. That's it. A lot of great calls today. And they're always great calls. We'll be back tomorrow. Maybe we'll have some more great calls. Hopefully we will. Hopefully some great Twitter questions. Hopefully some great guests. There's one way to find out. Tune in tomorrow at noon Eastern time. Tune in at 5:30 p.m. Eastern tonight for Pro Football Talk on NBCSN. If memory serves, we're going to be talking about the Chiefs, the Panthers, and the Bears. We're doing this team-by-team, careful look at where they are, where they stand, what the expectations are, etc. Chiefs, Panthers, Bears tonight, unless I'm horribly wrong, and there's a chance that I am. Check us out around the clock at ProFootballTalk.com. See you back here again tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.